Each year, 9 billion broiler chickens, 250 million turkeys, 113 million pigs, and 33 million cows are raised and slaughtered in the United States in a sprawling factory farm system that's controlled by a handful of powerful corporations. The conditions many of those animals live in and how they're often killed is the subject of a new Rolling Stone investigation by the magazine's contributing editor, Paul Solotaroff. It's called In the Belly of the Beast, and it chronicles the lives of many of the animals we eat before they reach our plates, questions whether animal cruelty is the price we pay for cheap meat. Mr. Solotaroff joins us now. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hi.
Pleased to be here.
We also have a link to your article on our show page at WNYC.org. How have our meat production systems changed in the last few decades? Has there been greater consolidation by agribusinesses on all the levels of production?
Yeah. What has happened is this massive takeover of small, mid-sized family farms, generations old, by enormous multinational corporations.
Smith, you call them big meat.
Big meat. I call them a cabal. I call them a cadre. There has been this hegemonic usurping of the market by these enormous Fortune 500 companies who have subsequently bought up everybody else and moved all of these animals, you know, who've lived for millennia in pastures, seen sun, felt the rain, but no longer do so, live entirely indoors.
Would we recognize the names of most of the companies you're writing about?
Absolutely, yeah. I just named several. Tyson, Purdue, Smithfield Farms, Cargill, on and on. But there are about a dozen of these multinational, multi-platform companies who completely now control the production of and sale of meat in this country.
And you write that chickens, for example, look less like hens and more like an oil-spill duck, and that they wheeze and gasp like a retired miner. What conditions are they living in?
They are living in enormous football field-long silos in which they are trapped 8 to 10 to a cage with less than a loose leaf paper-sized domain to roost and sleep in. They're housed in these cages that are stacked 6, sometimes 8 high and thousands long, and they know nothing from the moment of their birth but the dung of the animals above them coating their feathers and beaks and eyes.
Well, they're grown for their meat. What would have happened if I were to take one of them and put it out into a pasture? Would it be able to act like a normal chicken?
It can barely stand. They've completely lost the use of their legs. They can't flap. They've been bred for their plumpness.
Big breasts.
Their breasts, but they've also been so heavily saturated with antibiotics, growth hormones, that they no longer resemble the animals that they looked like 40, 50 years ago.
And you're right that pigs in factory farms spend 4 or 5 years in a tiny crate. They're kept perpetually pregnant, made sick from breathing in their own waste, while they're fed food packed with growth-promoting drugs, and sometimes even garbage.
Often garbage. Nothing ever goes to waste.
I thought only goats ate garbage.
Pigs could definitely give them a run for their money at a trash-eating contest on Coney Island.
What kind of not just anything. They must be selective about the trash.
They're feeding them whatever falls on the ground. Everything gets swept up and recycled on a factory farm, including the dung from not just the animals, which gets repackaged and sold as manure, but the dung of the humans who work on these farms. And I feel awful calling them farms. They don't resemble farms. They resemble massive federal penitentiaries, or worse. What do they eat? They eat ground glass from broken fluorescent light bulbs.
And syringes, you say?
They eat the syringes that they are stuck with, injected from virtually the moment of their birth with growth hormone antibiotics. They are fed the testicles of their young piglets.
No, wait, wait, because they are castrating the piglets so that they will grow fatter?
There are lots of reasons for castrating piglets, but it's done very early in life and without an anesthetic, much the way they crop their tails. Pigs lose their tails because they are so closely confined that if you don't remove their tails, they will bite one another on the tail for lack of anything to do all day.
Okay, let's move on to milk cows. Would most of the cows used for milking even be able to graze in the wild if they were let out of their pens?
Depends on when you got them. By the time they're in full production, by about 9, 10 months, a year of age, they're already so grossly distended, their udders are, that they can barely stand, let alone walk. Moreover, what these activists who infiltrate these massive factory farms told me is that the animals are so panicked by the sensation of sun, air, and fresh water that they startle and run and trip, break bones, and are essentially dead at that point.
I have been to the farm of a cheesemaker, Jonathan White, who's been breeding his cows back to prehistoric types. They look quite different from the milk cows. And he says that the typical milk cow is bred to produce a lot of milk for just a few years. His cows produce less milk, but they do it for more years and they don't get sick.
Right. So when you confine dairy cows, Holsteins, in these tiny enclosures about the size of their bodies for their entire productive lives, they get very, very sick because they're standing in their own waste for years and years. They develop all of these grotesque sores. They develop infections on their udders. And they eventually collapse under their own weight, at which point they become what's called downer cows. And when they're downer cows, they're technically or theoretically unavailable for human consumption. But in fact, many of these massive companies and their affiliates have been not only selling these cows, but they've been selling them to the USDA for school lunch programs.
A milk cow can give 22,000 pounds of milk a year, which is double what we would have expected from a cow 40 years ago. And that's because we keep them in these conditions?
Right. And why are they...
And keep the calves from them? What do calves drink when they're born? Isn't the whole idea of a cow's milk to feed their babies?
Calves, unless they are genetically select Holsteins, are completely worthless. And they are dumped on the spot market. They're called beef trash. And they're sold for $40 a head when they're a week or two old. I attended a couple of livestock auctions in upstate New York and was absolutely horrified by what I saw concerning the treatment of the most beautiful creatures on earth, namely these week and two-week-old calves, who are about as affectionate and as sentient an animal as you're likely to encounter in the wild.
You're right about being mobbed by a group of factory farm calves who started sucking on your leather jacket.
Yeah, so desperate were they for any nourishment at all because they don't get fed. Again, they're going to be killed for slaughter. And since they're largely worthless, they are ground up for dog food.
But some of them must be allowed to grow into adulthood. After all, we need adult cows, don't we?
Right. But many of the progeny of Holsteins aren't useful to meat manufacturers. They don't grow big like Angus, and they don't produce tons and tons of milk the way Holsteins do. So they get discarded. And it happens by the hundreds and hundreds of thousands.
My guest is Paul Solotaroff, who's a contributing editor to Rolling Stone. His article in The Belly of the Beast is online and in the current issue of the magazine. At one point, you bring up Abu Ghraib. Do you believe these animals are being tortured as well?
You know, Leonard, when I was racking my head to try and find a suitable comparison for the treatment of factory-raised animals, I couldn't conjure another scenario in which our control and management of animals qualified. Honestly, the only thing that works as a viable analogy is what went on in the concentration camps.
Now, why have so many of these animals been moved indoors over the last few decades? There is still plenty of land out there.
Sure.
And grass-fed is actually adds to the price. So I would think that farmers would be moving in the opposite direction.
Well, what happened is as the...
Like Argentina, which where most of the beef is grass-fed.
Sure. Well, when massive corporations move in on a market, what they do is eliminate the slack in the market. And so slack is needing to employ many, many people to manage animals. When you move them indoors in these tiny enclosures, you need vastly fewer people. You require vastly less amounts of natural additives or ingredients. And so you're able to economize on a massive scale.
But then you got to feed them antibiotics because that close proximity leads to the spread of illness.
Of course, of course. And when you keep animals in these kinds of enclosures, they're essentially born without immune systems to begin with. So very often, particularly on hen farms, workers or pig farms, workers must essentially go through hazmat procedures before they're allowed to enter the facility. They take these chemical showers going in. They put on these starch-clean jumpsuits, and then the reverse process when they leave.
I'm assuming that most consumers, based on just what I know from my own life, don't want to think about where and under what conditions their meat originates. I used to work for a supermarket chain. I did their ads. And when we once ran an ad with pictures of cows in the ad, sales went down immediately. Mm-hmm. It was okay to show the a steak or ground beef, but not the cow itself.
Yeah, yeah. Well, to the extent you see a cow or a chicken in advertising, they're typically an amusing and sarcastic, cartoon or animatronic character. But that bears zero relationship to the facts.
A listener called in is wondering what meat she as a consumer should buy. Are there certain labels that would indicate that the animals haven't been treated this way?
Sure. So just about everywhere an enlightened consumer lives and shops, there are farmers markets. You know, there are five or six major ones here in New York City where upstate growers who don't function in these brutalizing and intensely commodified ways sell their product. Typically, it's
at a much higher price,
significantly higher. But, you know, that should not disqualify them in the eyes of consumers. First of all, it's hard to put a price on eating food that will not make you sick, that will not subject you to salmonella, E. coli, and bovine spongiform encephalitis.
What about the antibiotics that we're injecting into them? Are they're coming into our bodies as well?
They are in...
Are they not excreted?
Of course, some are, but, you know, you are changing the genetic structure of these animals. And those substances are embedded in every piece of tissue we're consuming.
You profile two activists with the Humane Society, whom you call Sarah and Juan. Their videos of animal conditions in agribusiness barns have led to arrests and shutdowns of processing plants. But are they able to go after only a handful of producers?
Absolutely, because they themselves are but a handful. Humane Society, which is now essentially the conscience of record in this country in terms of policing the production of meat. You know, as I say in the piece, this used to be properly the job of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, but it is so morally and financially compromised by its arrangements with and for big meat that it doesn't bother any longer to do these inspections except on slaughterhouse floors.
Well, wouldn't Sarah and Juan be open to arrest in some states?
They are now. So as a result of their extraordinarily brave and effective infiltrations, states in the flyover portion of the country are now passing what's known as ag gag laws, which criminalize the work that these young people do by making it illegal to take a factory farm job under an assumed identity, by making it illegal to hold on to any evidence picked up with their pinhole cameras and body mics longer than 24 or 48 hours, and for that matter, to take footage of the practices at a factory farm while standing on public ground, i.e. from a road or inside the confines of your own car.
On the other hand, other states like California, Maine, and Oregon have passed laws that reduce animal cruelty. Is this just another case of two Americas that the many politicians have been talking about?
I think at least two Americas. But what's crazy is that every consumer wants to feed their children healthy food, wants to have confidence that's what is going in their mouths, isn't just sanitary, but was raised in decent and humane conditions. And that isn't a red state, blue state matter. You know, anyone who loves his children would recoil at the practices that have become now legion.
And you're also giving a lot of fuel to the vegetarian fire.
Well, I'm not a vegetarian and don't plan on becoming one. I love the taste of meat, and I won't apologize for it. What I am giving light and a little air to are the extraordinary new generation of farmers who have come along and are determined to grow not just meat, but crops in a thoroughly sustainable and responsible way.
You note that the USDA typically only sends inspectors to slaughterhouses, so they don't even look at these farms?
No. You know, unless there is an outbreak of something. For instance, a couple of years ago, there was a massive salmonella epidemic in 22 states as a result of eggs that came from several just horribly contaminated egg barns. Government inspectors never set foot in these places. And to the extent that they inspect meat that is about to be slaughtered, they overlook enormous wildly obvious violations right under their noses.
What kinds of penalties do the companies that are caught with these violations have to face?
Well, I mentioned before that there was this massive takedown by Humane Society of a particularly evil operation in California, Westfield Farms. I'm sorry, Hallmark Farms. And that boondoggle cost, well, eventually it shut down the plant and put its owners out of business, but it cost billions of dollars and incited riots in Korea where we were dumping this bad meat on consumers. Those guys faced no charges. A couple of their workers were arrested and given slaps on the wrist for maltreatment of animals. That was the extent of the price paid.
And your activist, Sarah, points out that when she is successful, it means a lot of people lose jobs, so she feels a bit guilty at the same time.
She does, but she's there on behalf of the animals. And this is not to say that the workers in these horrific places are treated with any more humanity than the animals themselves. They're not. They're asked to do the most repugnant jobs. They're paid horrifically, and fired at moment's notice.
Yesterday, the FDA released proposals. One is a set of recommendations on how the drug industry should voluntarily revise the rules around antibiotic use, and the other would require a veterinarian sign-off before administering certain antibiotics that are commonly used in humans to animals. Are there any risks to keeping the current antibiotic use policy in place?
There's enormous risks. You know, we have developed a pantheon now of antibiotic-resistant bugs, which, you know, most scientists agree is entirely the yield of dosing ourselves in the secondhand fashion. The difficulty with or the shortcoming with the legislation yesterday is that it only outlaws use for plumping up animals, farmers can continue to use massive amounts of antibiotics as a disease prophylactic.
We have only 30 seconds, but you call the factory farming one of the filthiest industries in America. Where does all the waste go?
Well, depends on whose waste we're talking about. If it's pigs, it goes into something called manure lagoons and very often contaminates rivers and topsoil and forces whole communities to move.
Now, we've heard about legislation proposed to be a bit more humane, but it never seems to go anywhere.
It does go places, but it's case by case and state by state, and there's been nothing like an overhaul of federal regulations.
We have a link to Paul Solotaroff's article in the Belly of the Beast. That's in the current issue of Rolling Stone, also online at Rolling Stone. You can find it on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being on our show.
I'm flattered. Thanks so much.